"Oh, I will. So I will," he growled, then flung out angrily, "You insult my honor if you think I cannot."
As Taran stood among these rough warriors, he began to despair of finding any means of convincing the prickly-tempered Cantrev lord. The thought crossed his mind to draw blade and fight his way out as best he could, but another glance at the stern faces of the henchmen gave him only more cause for dismay. "My lord," Taran said firmly, "I speak the truth. There were no giants, but my companion and myself, and a farmer who fought beside us."
"No giants?" shouted Gorion. "But more insults!"
He stamped his foot, as if the turf itself had given him some impertinence.
"You call my men liars? As well call me one!"
"My lord," Taran began again, bowing deeply, for it was growing clear to him that Gorion's touchy honour could scarcely allow the Cantrev lord to believe an account of simple horse-stealing. And there was, Taran realized, even for the border band themselves, considerably more honour in overcoming giants than in robbing assistant pig-keepers. "I call no man liar, and your men spoke the truth. The truth," he added, "as they saw it."
"Insolence!" cried Gorion. "The truth as it is! There were giants, monsters, uprooted oaks. My men were well rewarded for their valour, but you shall have a beating for your impudence."
"What I believe, my lord, is this," Taran went on, choosing his words carefully, since all he had thus far managed to say Gorion had turned into one kind of insult or another. "The sun was low, and our shadows made our number seem twice as great. Indeed, your men saw double what we truly were." "As for giants," Taran hurried on before the Cantrev lord could cry out against another impertinence, "again, the long shadows of sunset gave us such height that any man could mistake our size."
"The oak tree cudgel," Lord Gorion began.
"The farmer bore a stout oaken staff," Taran said. "His arm was strong, his blows quick, as two of your men had good reason to know. He smote with such a mighty hand, small wonder they felt a tree had fallen on them." Lord Gorion said nothing for a moment, but sucked a tooth and rubbed his bristling beard.
"What of the monster? A raving, ferocious creature they saw with their own eyes."
"The monster stands before you," Taran answered, pointing to Gurgi. "He has long been my companion. I know him to be gentle, but the fiercest foe when roused."
"He is Gurgi, yes, yes," Gurgi shouted. "Bold, clever, and fierce to fight for kindly master."
With this he bared his teeth, shook his hairy arms, and yelled so frightfully that Gorion and his henchmen drew backward a pace. The face of the Cantrev lord had begun to furrow in deep perplexity. He shifted his bulk from one foot to another and glared at Taran.
"Shadows," he growled. "You mean to shadow the bravery of those who serve me? Another insult!"
"If your warriors believed they had seen what they claimed," Taran said, "and fought accordingly, their bravery is no less. Indeed," he added, half under his breath, "it is every bit as great as their truthfulness."
"These are no more than words," interrupted the Master of Horse. "Show me deeds. There is no creature on four hooves that I cannot ride, save this one. You, churl, will you dare to mount?"
For answer, Taran swung quickly into the saddle. Melinlass whinnied, pawed the ground, then stood calmly. Lord Gorion choked with amazement, and the Master of Horse stared in disbelief. A surprised murmur rose from Gorion's henchmen, but Taran heard a rough laugh as one of them called,
"Soho, Gorion, a lout rides a steed a lord has not mastered, and takes your horse and honour both."
Taran thought he had seen a faint flicker of relief in Gorion's bruised face, as though he were not altogether displeased to avoid riding Melinlass. But at the henchman's words, the Cantrev lord's features began to darken furiously. "Not so," Taran hastily cried out to the circle of men. "Would you have your liege lord ride a pig-keeper's nag? Is that fitting to his honour?" He turned now to Gorion, for a bold thought had come to him. "And yet, my lord, were you to take him as a gift from me?"
"What?"
shouted Gorion at the top of his voice, his face turning livid.
"Insults! Impertinence! Insolence! How dare you?
I take no gifts from pig-keepers, nor will I lower myself to mount the beast again.
He flung up an arm.
Begone! Out of my sight! Your nag, your monster, and his pony along with you!
Gorion snapped his jaws shut and said no more. Gurgi's pony was led from the stable, and under the eyes of the Cantrev lord and his henchmen, the two companions passed unhindered through the gate. Taran rode slowly, head high, with all the assurance he could muster. But once out of sight of the stronghold, the companions clapped heels into their horses' flanks and galloped for dear life.
"Oh, wisdom that wins horses from prideful lord,"
Gurgi cried, when they had ridden far enough to be safe from any change of heart on the part of Gorion.
"Even Gurgi could not have been so clever. Oh, he wishes to be wise as kindly master, but his poor tender head has no skill in such thinkings."
"My wisdom," Taran laughed, "barely enough to make up for losing Melinlas in the first place." He scanned the valley anxiously. Night was falling, and he had hoped by this time to have come upon a farmhold where they might shelter, for the encounter with Gorion's border band had given him no wish to learn what others might be roving the hills. But he saw neither cottage nor hut, and so pressed on through the purpling dusk. Lights flared in a clearing ahead, and Taran reined Melinlas to a halt, near a stronghold, much like Lord Gorion's. But here torches blazed at every corner of the palisade, from sockets set high on either side of the gate, even at the roof-tree of the great hall, as if in token of feasting and revelry within.
"Dare we stop here?" Taran said. "If this Cantrev lord shows us Gorion's courtesy, we'd sleep sounder in a Gwythaint's nest."
Nevertheless, the hope of a comfortable bed and the torch's inviting glow made his weariness weigh all the heavier. He hesitated a moment, then urged Melinlas closer to the gate. To the men in the watchtower, Taran called out that here were wayfarers journeying to Caer Cadarn and known to King Smoit. He was relieved when the portal creaked open and the guards beckoned the pair to enter. The chief steward was summoned, and he led Taran and Gurgi to the great hall.
"Beg hospitality of my lord Gast," the steward told them, "and he will grant what he deems fitting."
As he followed the steward, Taran's spirits rose at the thought of a warm meal and a comfortable couch. Loud voices, laughter, and the merry notes of a harp came from the hall. Stepping through the doorway, Taran saw crowded tables on either side of a low-ceilinged room. At the far end, flanked by his henchmen and their ladies, sat a richly garbed warlord, a drinking horn in one fist, and most of a joint of meat in the other. Taran and Gurgi bowed deeply. Before they could draw closer, the harper standing in the middle of the hall turned, cried out in surprise, and ran to them. Taran, whose hand was being shaken half off his arm, found himself blinking with happy astonishment at the long, pointed nose and spiky yellow hair of his old companion, Fluda Flam.
"Well met, the two of you," cried the bard, pulling them to the high table. "I have missed you ever since we parted. Did you not stay at Caer Dalban? When we sailed from Mona," Fluda hurriedly explained, "I really meant to leave off wandering and settle down in my own realm. Then I said to myself, 'Fluda, old fellow, spring's only once a year. And here it is, and here am I. But what of yourselves? First food and drink, and your tidings later.'"
Fluda had brought the companions to stand before Lord Gast, and Taran saw a heavy-featured warrior with a beard the colour of muddy flax. A handsome collar-piece dangled from his neck, rings glittered on fingers stout enough to crack walnuts, and bands of beaten silver circled his arms. The Cantrev lord's raiment was costly and well-cut, but Taran saw it bore the spots and spatters not only of this feast, but of many others long past. The bard, with a sweep of his harp, named the companions to Lord Gast.
"These are two who sought the black cauldron from Aurorn of Anuvin, and fought at the side of Gwydion, Prince of Don. Let your hospitality match their boldness."
"And so it shall,"
Gast loudly cried.
"No wayfarer can fault the hospitality of Gast the Generous."
He made place for the companions at his table, and sweeping aside the empty bowls and dishes before him, clapped his hands and bawled for the steward. When the servitor arrived, Lord Ghast commanded him to bring such an array of food and drink that Taran could hardly imagine himself eating half of it. Gergi, hungry as always, smacked his lips in gleeful anticipation. As the steward left, Lord Ghast took up a tale, whose matter Taran found difficult to follow, concerning the costliness of his food and his open-handedness toward travellers. Taran listened courteously through it all, surprised and delighted at his good luck in finding Ghast's stronghold. Feeling more at ease, thanks to the presence of Fluda, Taran at last ventured to speak of his meeting with Lord Gorion.
"Gorion!" snorted Ghast.
"Arrogant boor! Crude lout! Braggart and boaster! To boast of what?"
He snatched up a drinking horn.
"See this!"
he cried.
"The name of Ghast carved upon it, and the letters worked in gold. See this cup, this bowl? These ornament my common table. My storehouse holds even finer, as you shall see. Gorion, horse flesh is all he knows, and little enough of that."
Fluda, meanwhile, had raised the harp to his shoulder and began to strike up a tune.
"It's a small thing I composed myself," he explained, "though I must say it's been cheered and praised by thousands."
No sooner were the words past his lips than the harp bent like an overdrawn bow, and a string broke with a loud twang.
"Drat the thing,"
muttered the bard.
"Will it give me no peace? I swear it's getting worse. The slightest bit of colour added to the facts, and it costs me a string. Yes, as I meant to say, I know full half a dozen who deemed the song, rather well done."
With deftness born of long, sad practice, Fluda knotted up the broken string. Taran, glancing around the hall this while, was surprised to realize the plates and drinking horns of the guests were more than half empty, and, in fact, showed no sign of ever having been full. His perplexity grew when the steward returned to set the food-laden tray before Lord Ghast, who planted his elbows on either side of it.
"Eat your fill,"
cried Ghast to Taran and Gergi, pushing a small hunch of gravy-spotted bread toward them, and keeping the rest for himself.
"Ghast the generous is ever open-handed. A sad fault that may turn me into a pauper, but it's my nature to be free with all my goods. I can't fight against it."
"Generous?" Taran murmured under his breath to Fluda, while Gergi, swallowing the skimpy fare, looked hopelessly around for more. "I think he'd make a miser seem a prodigal in comparison." So passed the meal, with Ghast loudly urging the companions to stuff themselves, yet all the while grudgingly offering them no more than a few morsels of stringy meat from the heaped platter. Only at the end, when Ghast had swallowed all he could, and his head nodded sleepily, and his beard straggled into his drinking horn, were the companions able to down the meagre leavings. At last, disheartened and with bellies still hollow, the three groped their way to a meanly furnished chamber, where they nevertheless dropped into sleep like stones. In the morning, Taran was impatient to start once more for Caer Cadarn, and Fluda agreed to ride with him. But Lord Ghast would hear none of it, until the companions marvelled at his storerooms. The Cantrev Lord flung open chests of goblets, ornaments, weapons, horse trappings, and many things Taran judged of high value, but in such a muddled heap that he could scarcely tell one from another. Among all these goods, Taran's eyes lingered on a gracefully fashioned wine bowl, the most beautiful Taran had ever seen. He had, however, little chance to admire it, for the Cantrev Lord quickly thrust a garishly ornamented horse bridle into Taran's hands, and as quickly replaced it with a pair of stirrups, which he praised equally.
"That wine bowl is worth all the rest put together," Fluda whispered to Taran,
as Lord Ghast now led the three companions from the storehouse to a large cow pen just outside the barricade.
"I recognize the work from the hand of Anlor Clayshaper, a master craftsman, the most skilled potter in Prydain. I swear his wheel is enchanted. Poor Ghast," Fluda added, "to count himself rich and know so little of what he owns."
"But how has he gained such treasure?" Taran said.
"On that score, I should hesitate to ask," Fluda murmured with a grin. "Very likely the same way Gorion gained your horse."
"And this?"
cried the Cantrev Lord, halting beside a black cow who stood peacefully grazing amid the rest of the herd.
"And this is Cornillo, the finest cow in all the land."
Taran could not gainsay the words of the Cantrev Lord, for Cornillo shone as if she had been polished, and her short, curving horns sparkled in the sun. Lord Gast proudly stroked the animal's sleek flanks.
"Gentle as a lamb, strong as an ox, swift as a horse and wise as an owl,"
Gast went on, while Cornillo, calmly munching her cud, turned patient eyes to Taran, as though hoping not to be mistaken for anything other than a cow.
"She leads my cattle," declared Lord Gast, "better than any herdsman can. She'll pull a plough, or turn a gristmill if need be. Her calves are always twins. As for milk, she gives the sweetest. Cream, every drop. So rich the dairymaids can scarcely churn it."
Cornillo blew out her breath almost in a sigh, switched her tail, and went back to grazing. From the pasture, Lord Gast pressed the companions to the hen roost, and from there to the hawk mews, and the morning was half spent, and Taran had begun to despair of ever leaving the stronghold, when Gast finally ordered their mounts readied. Fluda, Taran saw, still rode Lian, the huge golden tawny cat, who had saved the companions' lives on the Isle of Mona.
"Yes, I decided to keep her. Rather, she's decided to keep me," said the bard, as Lian, recognizing Taran, padded forward and began happily rubbing her head against his shoulder. "She loves the harp more than ever," Fluda went on. "Can't hear enough of it."
No sooner did he say this than Lian flicked her long whiskers and turned to give the bard a forceful nudge, so that Fluda then and there had to unsling his instrument and strike a few chords, while Lian, purring loudly, blinked fondly at him with great yellow eyes.
"Farewell,"
called the Cantrev Lord as the companions mounted.
"At the stronghold of Gast the Generous, you'll ever find an open-handed welcome."
"It's a generosity that could starve us to death," Taran, laughing, remarked to the bard as they rode eastward again. "Gast thinks himself open-handed, as Gorion thinks himself valorous, and as far as I can judge, neither one has the truth of it. Yet," he added, "they both seem pleased with themselves. Indeed, is a man truly what he sees himself to be?"
"Only if what he sees is true," answered Fluda. "If there's too great a difference between his own opinion and the facts, then, my friend, I should say that such a man had no more substance to him than Gorion's giants." "Don't judge them too harshly," the bard went on. "These Cantrev nobles are much alike, prickly as porcupines one moment, and friendly as puppies the next. They all hoard their possessions, yet they can be generous to a fault if the mood strikes them. As for valor, they're no cowards. Death rides in the saddle with them, and they count it nothing. And in battle I've seen them gladly lay down their lives for a comrade. At the same time," he added, "it's also been my experience, in all my wanderings, that the farther from the deed, the greater it grows, and the most glorious battle is the one longest past. So it's hardly surprising how many heroes you run into." "Had they harps like mine," said Fluda, warily glancing at his instrument, "what a din you'd hear from every stronghold in Prydain."
Chapter 4 A Matter of Cows. Late that afternoon, the companions sighted the crimson banner of the House of Smoit, its black bear emblem flying bravely above the towers of Caer Cadarn. Unlike the palisaded strongholds of the Cantrev lords, Smoit's castle was a fortress with walls of hewn stone and iron-studded gates thick enough to withstand all attack. The chips in the stones and the dents in the portal told Taran the castle had indeed thrown back not a few assaults. For the three travellers, however, the gates were flung open willingly, and an honour guard of spearmen hastened to escort the companions. The red-bearded king sat at the dining table in his great hall, and from the array of dishes, platters, and drinking horns, both full and empty, Taran judged Smoit could scarcely have left off eating since morning. Seeing the companions, the king leapt from his throne of oakwood, fashioned in the shape of a gigantic bear, looking much like Smoit himself.
My body and bones,
Smoit roared so loudly the dishes rattled on the table.
It's better than a feast to see all of you.
His battle-scarred face beamed with delight, and he flung his burly arms around the companions in a joint-cracking hug.
Scrape out a tune from that old pot of yours,
he cried to Fluda.
A merry tune for a merry meeting. And you, my lad,
he went on, seizing Taran's shoulders with his heavy, red-furred hands.
When last we met, you looked scrawny as a plucked chicken. And your shaggy friend, what, has he rolled in the bushes all the way from Caer Dalban?
Smoit clapped his hands, shouted for more food and drink, and would hear nothing of Taran's news until the companions had eaten and the king had downed another full meal.
The Mirror of Lunet,
said Smoit, when Taran at last was able to tell of his quest.
I've heard of no such thing. As well seek a needle in a haystack as a looking-glass in the Lorgadon Mountains.
The king's heavy brow furrowed, and he shook his head.
The Lorgadons rise in the land of the Free Comets, and whether the folk there will be of a mind to help you.
The Free Comets? Taran asked. I've heard them named, but know little else about them.
They're hamlets and small villages, Fluda put in. They start to the east of the hill Cantrevs, and spread as far as Great Averin. I've never journeyed there myself. The Free Comets are a bit far even for my ramblings. But the land itself is the pleasantest in Prydain. Fair hills and dales, rich soil to farm, and sweet grass for grazing. There's iron for good blades, gold and silver for fine ornaments. Anlor Clayshaper is said to dwell among the comet folk, as do many other craftsmen. Master weavers, metalsmiths, from time out of mind their skills have been the comet's pride.
A proud folk they are,
said Smoit,
and a stiff-necked breed. They bow to no Cantrev lords, but only to the High King Math himself.
No Cantrev lords? Asked Taran, puzzled. Who then rules them?
Why, they rule themselves, answered Smoit. Strong and steadfast they are, too. And, by my beard, I'm sure there's more peace and neighborliness in the Free Comets than anywhere else in Prydain. And so what need have they for kings or lords? When you come to the meat of it, he added, a king's strength lies in the will of those he rules.
Taran, who had been listening closely to these words of Smoit, nodded his head. I had not thought of it thus, he said, half to himself. Indeed, true allegiance is only given willingly.
Enough talk,
cried Smoit.
It hurts my head and dries my gullet. Let's have more meat and drink. Forget the mirror. Tarry with me in my Cantrev, lad. We'll ride to the hunt, feast, and make merry. You'll put more flesh on your bones here than scrambling about on a fool's errand. And that, my boy, is good counsel to you.
Nevertheless, when he finally saw that Taran would not be dissuaded, Smoit good-naturedly agreed to give the companions all they needed for the journey. Next morning, after a huge breakfast, which Smoit declared would serve to whet their appetites for dinner, the king threw open his storehouse to them and went with them to be sure they chose the best of gear. Taran had only begun sorting through coils of rope, saddlebags, and harness leather, when one of the castle guards burst into the storeroom calling,
Sire, a horseman of Lord Gast is come. Raiders from Lord Gorion's stronghold have stolen Gast's prize cow, and the rest of the herd with her.
My pulse, roared Smoit, my breath and blood.
The king's tangled bush of eyebrows knotted, and his face turned as red as his beard.
How does he dare stir trouble in my Cantrev?
The men of Gast have armed. They ride against Gorion, the guard hastened on. Gast craves your help. Will you speak to his messenger?
Speak to him,
bellowed Smoit.
I'll clap his master in irons for breaking the peace, and worse, for breaking it without my leave.
Put Gast in irons? Taran asked with some perplexity. But Gorion stole his cow.
His cow?
Cried Smoit.
His cow indeed. Gast stole her from Gorion himself last year, and before that, the other way around. Neither of them knows whose beast it rightly is. Those two brawlers have ever been at loggerheads. Now the warm weather heats their blood again, but I'll cool their tempers. In my dungeon, Gast and Gorion both.
Smite snatched up a mighty double-edged battle-axe.
I'll fetch them back by the ears, he roared. They know my dungeons. They've been there often enough. Who rides with me?
I will, cried Fluda, his eyes lighting up. Great Belin, a flam never shuns a fight.
If you ask our help, sire, Taran began, we give it willingly, but...
Mount up then, my lad, shouted Smite. You'll see justice done, and I'll have peace between Gast and Gorion if I have to break their heads to gain it.
Swinging his battle-axe, Smite bolted from the storeroom, bellowing orders right and left. A dozen warriors sprang to horse. Smite leapt astride a tall, barrel-chested steed, whistled through his teeth almost loudly enough to break them, and waved his men onward. Amid the shouting and confusion, Taran, bewildered, found himself atop Melinlas, galloping across the courtyard and out the castle gate. The red-bearded king set such a pace through the valleys that it put even Lian on her mettle to keep up, while Gurgi, with most of the wind pounded out of him, clung to the neck of his frantically galloping pony. Smoit's warhorse was in a lather, and so was Melinlas, before the Cantrev king signalled a halt.
"To meet!"
Smoit cried, swinging out of the saddle and looking as unwearied as if he had just begun a morning's trot. The companions, still catching their breath, had by no means found their appetites, but Smoit clapped his hands to the heavy bronze belt around his middle.
"Hunger makes a man gloomy, and saps all the spirit from a battle."
"Sire, must we battle with Lord Gast?" Taran asked with some concern, for Smoit's warband numbered only the dozen who had ridden from Caer Cadarn. "And if Lord Gorion's men have armed, we may be too few to stand against all of them."
"Battle?"
Smoit retorted.
"No, more's the pity. I'll have those troublemakers by the nose and into my dungeons before nightfall. They'll do as I command. I'm their king by my beard. There's brawn enough here," he added, shaking a mighty fist, "to make them remember it."
"And yet," Taran ventured to say, "you yourself told me a king's true strength lay in the will of those he ruled."
"How's that?"
cried Smoit, who had settled his bulk against a tree trunk and was about to attack the joint of meat he had pulled from his saddlebag.
"Don't puzzle me with my own words. My body and bones... A king is a king!"
"I meant only that you've locked Gast and Gorion in your dungeon many times before," Taran answered, "and still they quarrel. Is there no way to keep peace between them? Or make them understand..."
"I'll reason them reasons,"
bellowed Smoit, clutching his battle-axe. He knitted his jutting brows.
"But true enough it is,"
he admitted, frowning and seeming to chew at the thought, as if it were gristle in his meat.
"They go surly to the dungeon and surly leave it. You struck on something there, my lad. The dungeon's useless against that pair. And my pulse, I know why. It needs more dampness, more draught. So be it. I'll have the place well watered down tonight."
Taran was about to remark that his own thought was otherwise, but Fluda called out and pointed to a horseman galloping across the meadow.
"He wears the colours of Gorion,"
shouted Smoit, jumping to his feet, still holding the joint in one hand and the battle-axe in the other. Two of the warriors quickly mounted and, drawing swords, spurred to engage the rider. But the horseman, brandishing his weapon hilt downward, cried out that he bore tidings from the Cantrev lord.
"You rogue!"
Smoit bellowed, dropping both meat and axe and collaring the rider to haul him bodily from the saddle.
"What other mischiefs afoot? Speak! Give me your news, man, or I'll have it out of you along with your gizzard."
"Sire,"
gasped the messenger,
"Lord Gast attacks in strength. My Lord Gorion is hard-pressed. He has ordered more of his warriors to arm, and calls on you to help him as well."
"What of the cows?"
cried Smoit.
"Has Gast won them back? Does Gorion still hold them?"
"Neither, sire,"
answered the messenger as well as he could, with Smoit shaking him between every word.
"Lord Gast attacked Lord Gorion to regain his own herd and take Lord Gorion's too. But as they fought, all the beasts frighted and ran off. The cows, sire, both herds are gone, lost, every soul of them, and Cornillo herself."
"Let that be the end of it," declared Smoit, "and a good lesson for all cow-robbers. Gast and Gorion shall cry peace and I'll spare them from my dungeon.
Sire, the fighting grows hotter,
the messenger said urgently.
Neither one will leave off. Each blames the other for the loss of his herd. Lord Gorion swears vengeance on Lord Ghast, and Lord Ghast swears vengeance on Lord Gorion.
They've both been itching for battle,
Smite burst out.
Now they find their excuse.
He summoned one of his warriors, ordering him to take Gorion's messenger to Kaer Kadan, there to be held as hostage.
To horse the rest of you,
Smite commanded.
My body and bones, we'll see sport after all.
He gripped his axe.
Oh, there'll be heads broken today,
he cried with relish, and his battered face brightened as if he were on his way to a feast.
The bards will sing of this,
exclaimed Fluda, carried away by Smoit's ardour.
A flam in the thick of battle. The thicker the better.
The harp shuddered, and a string snapped in two.
I mean, Fluda hastily added, I hope we're not too badly outnumbered.
Sire, Taran called as Smoit strode to his warhorse, if Ghast and Gorion won't stop because their herds are lost, shouldn't we try to find the cows?
Yes, yes,
Gurgi put in.
Find cows gone with strayings, and put an end to fightings and smitings.
But Smite had already mounted, and was shouting for the warband to follow, and Taran could do no more than gallop after him. To which stronghold Smite was leading them, Taran did not know. As far as Smite was concerned, Taran decided, it made little difference whether Ghast or Gorion fell first into the king's hands. In a while, however, Taran recognized the path he and Gurgi had taken from Eden's farm, and he judged now that Smite would make for Gorion's stronghold. But as they pounded across an open field, the king veered sharply left, and Taran glimpsed a troop of mounted warriors some distance away. At the sight of their banners, Smite bellowed furiously and spurred his steed to overtake the horsemen. But the riders, themselves galloping at top speed, quickly vanished into the woodland. Smite reined up, shouting after them and shaking his huge fist.
"Has Gorion put more warriors in the fray?"
roared Smite, his face crimson.
"Then Ghast has done the same. Those louts wore his colours."
"Sire," Taran began, "if we can find the cows—"
"Cows?"
burst out Smite.
"There's more than cows in this, my lad. Such a brawl can spread like a spark through tinder. Those thick-skulled ruffians will set the whole of Cadafor ablaze, and next thing you know, we'll all be at one another's throats. But by my beard, they'll learn my fist smites harder than theirs."
Smite hesitated, and his face darkened with deep concern. He scowled and tugged at his beard.
"The lords of the next cantref,"
he muttered,
"they'll not stand idle, but strike against us when they see we're fighting each other."
"The cows," Taran urged. "The three of us can seek them, while you—"
"The dungeon,"
cried Smite.
"I'll have Ghast and Gurion in it before their squabble gets further out of hand."
Smite clapped heels to his horse and charged forward, making no attempt to hold to any pathway, dashing at breakneck speed through bramble and thicket. With the companions and the train of warriors pelting behind, Smite clattered over the stones of a riverbank and plunged his horse into the swift current. The king had ill-chosen his fording place, for in another moment Taran found himself in water up to his saddle horn. Smite, shouting impatiently, pressed on across the river. Taran saw the king rise up in his stirrups to beckon his followers and urge more haste. But an instant later, the warhorse lost footing and lurched sideways. Steed and rider toppled with a mighty splash, and before Taran could spur Melinlas to him, Smite had been torn loose from his mount, and, like a barrel with arms and legs, was being borne quickly downstream. Behind Taran, some of the warriors had turned back, seeking to overtake the king by following along the riverbank. Taran, closer to the opposite bank, urged all strength from Melinlas, leapt from the saddle to dry ground, and raced along the shore after Smite. The sound of rushing water filled his ears, and with dismay, Taran realized the king was being pulled relentlessly to a waterfall. Heart bursting in his chest, Taran doubled his pace. Though before he could set foot in the rapids, he saw the king's red beard sink below the churning water, and he cried out in despair as Smite vanished over the brink. Chapter 5. A Judgment. Taran scrambled down the rocks jutting beside the high cascade. In a pool hammered into white spray, he could hardly make out Smoit's burly form spinning in the eddies. Heedless of the pounding water, Taran pitched through the falls and sprang into the pool. He groped for Smoit's belt and seized it at last. Battling the whirlpool and nearly drowning himself with his own efforts, Taran painfully strove to drag the half-conscious king into the shallows. Smoit was bleeding heavily from the forehead, and his ruddy face had gone chalky pale. Taran tugged at the king's waterlogged bulk, hauling him safely from the rolling waters. In another moment, Gergi and Fluda were beside him, helping to drag the king ashore. Smoit, like a beached whale, collapsed on the bank. Gergi, moaning anxiously, loosened the king's garments, while Taran and the bard hastily saw to Smoit's injuries.
"He can count himself lucky. He's only cracked his skull and half his ribs," Fluda said. "Another man would have been snapped in two. But we're in a fine pickle,"
he added under his breath to Taran, glancing at the warriors who had come to gather near the unconscious Smoit.
"He'll not lay Ghast or Gorion by the heels now. He needs more healing than we can give. We'd best take him to Kaer Kadan."
Taran shook his head. He remembered Smoit's words about the neighbouring Cantre of Lords, who would seize the opportunity to attack. It was in his mind, too, that finding Cornillo could best bring Ghast and Gorion to terms and thus end their battle. But his thoughts were as tangled as Ordu's weaving, and he fervently wished himself in the place of Smoit, whose unconsciousness at that moment seemed a most enviable state. "Eden's farmhold is closer," Taran said. "We'll bring him there, and Gergi shall stay with him. You and I must seek out Ghast and Gorion, and do what we can to stop their quarrel. As for Cornillo and the herd, I doubt we may hope to find them." The companions, tearing their cloaks into strips, set about binding up Smoit's wounds. The king's eyelids fluttered, and he groaned loudly.
"Give me to eat," gasped Smoit. "I may be half drowned, but I'll not be half starved."
He put a hand on Tyron's shoulder.
"Good lad, good lad. You saved my life. Another moment and I'd have been beaten into a pudding. Claim any favor. It is yours."
"I ask none," Taran replied, knotting the bandages around Smoit's huge chest. "Alas," he murmured, "what I most want, none can grant."
"No matter," panted Smoit. "What you wish of me, you shall have."
"Sire, you cannot travel far," Taran began as Smoit tried painfully to climb to his feet. "Give us leave to ride with your warriors and—"
"Kind master, here!"
Gergi called excitedly.
"Here with listenings."
Lian, too, had caught some sound, for her ears cupped forward and her whiskers twitched.
"It's my gizzard calling for meat and drink," cried Smoit. "Loud it must be, for I'm empty as a drum." "No, no," shouted Gergi,
seizing Taran's arm and drawing him past the trees along the riverside.
"Gergi hears no thrummings and drummings, but cooings and mooings."
Leaning on the bard, Smoit stumbled after them. Gergi had spoken the truth. The creature's sharp ears had not deceived him. Now Taran himself heard a faint lowing. Gergi raced toward the sound. Beyond the trees, the land dipped into a shady dell, watered by a streamlet. Taran cried aloud. There stood the herd, grazing calmly around Cornillo.
"My pulse!"
bellowed Smoit, so loudly that a dozen horned heads turned and stared as alarmed as if some strange new kind of bull had burst into their quiet pasture.
"Great Belin!" cried Fluda. "Cornillo's led them all to safety. She's wiser than either of her masters."
Cornillo raised her head as Taran hurried to her side. She blew out her breath gently and rolled her eyes in a look of long-suffering patience. Smoit, heedless of his grievous bruises, clapped his hands triumphantly and shouted at the top of his voice for his warriors. "Sire, let us drive the herd to Eden's farm," Taran urged. "Your own hurts must be tended better than we've done."
"Drive them where you please, lad," answered Smoit. "My body and bones, we have them now. That will fetch Ghast and Gorion to me at a gallop."
He summoned two horsemen, commanding them to bear a message to the Cantre of Lords.
"Tell those two troublemakers where I'll await them,"
cried Smoit,
"and tell each to call truce, for his cows are found." "And Gurgi found them,"
shouted Gurgi, capering wildly.
"Yes, yes, bold, clever, sharp-eared Gurgi finds all at his last. Oh, yes."
He flung his hairy arms around himself and seemed close to bursting with pride and delight at his own deed.
"Oh, bards will sing of clever Gurgi with rantings and chantings."
"I'm sure they will, old friend," Taran said. "You found the herd. But don't forget, we still have Gast and Gorion to deal with, and there's only one Cornillo." The cows were at first reluctant to quit the dell, but after much coaxing, Taran was able to lead Cornillo along the valley pathways toward Eden's farm. The others followed her, lowing and tossing their horns. It was a strange procession that wended its way across the meadows and rolling hillocks. Smoit's warriors rode on either side of the herd, and the red-bearded king himself brandished a spear as if it were a drover's staff. Lian padded after the cattle, alert for strays, and Gurgi perched proud as a shaggy rooster on Cornillo's back. When Eden's hut came in sight, Taran galloped ahead, calling to the farmer, but he had no sooner dismounted when the door burst open, and he fell back, surprised. Eden stood with a rusted sword in his hand. Behind the farmer, Taran glimpsed Alaka, weeping into her apron.
"Is this how you repay kindness?"
Eden cried, recognizing Taran immediately. His eyes blazed as he pointed the ancient weapon at the approaching warband.
"Do you come with them to spoil our land? Begone! It's already done!"
"How then?" Taran stammered, shocked at these words from one he held to be a friend. "I ride with King Smoit and his men. We seek peace between Gast and Gorion."
"Does it matter whose warriors trampled my crops?"
Eden flung back.
"What Gast has destroyed, Gorion has doubly destroyed, warring back and forth across my field, till not a blade of wheat stands. Battle is their pride, but my farm is my life. Do they seek vengeance? I sought only a harvest."
In the weariness of despair, Eden bowed his head and cast his sword to the ground. Taran stared in dismay at the field where Eden had so painfully labored. The hooves of steeds had churned the earth to mud, uprooting the young shoots which now lay torn to shreds. The harvest on which Eden had staked his livelihood would never come, and Taran felt the farmer's heartbreak as if it were his own. Before he could speak, a troop of horsemen galloped from the woods edging the farm. Taran recognized Lord Gorion at their head. In another moment, Lord Gast and his riders appeared. Catching sight of his rival, the Cantrev lord spurred his mount and galloped frantically to the cottage, flung himself out of the saddle, and with a furious shout raced toward Gorion.
"Robber!"
cried Gast.
"Do you mean to steal Cornillo from me again?"
"Thief!"
cried Gorion.
"I took what was mine to begin with."
"Liar!"
roared Gast.
"Never was she yours!"
"Insults! Insolence!"
roared Gorion, his face turning purple, his hand snatching for his sword.
"Be silent!"
bellowed Smoit. He shook his battle-axe at the Cantrev lords.
"Your king speaks! How dare you quarrel and insult each other, you pig-headed brawlers!"
Smoit gestured to his warriors, who strode to seize Gast and Gorion. The riders of the two warbands cried out angrily and made to unsheathe their swords. For an instant, Taran feared another battle would rage then and there. But Smoit's warriors stood their ground, and the sight of the enraged king himself caused the horsemen to draw back submissively.
"My dungeon will teach you to be good neighbors,"
cried Smoit.
"You'll stay there till you learn. As for Cornillo, I've split my skull, cracked my bones, and ridden to the edge of starvation this day, and so I claim her for myself. A prize of war, and small recompense it is for the vexation you've given me. Another day, and you'd have set the whole Cantrev ablaze."
At this, Gast and Gorion both roared in furious protest, and Taran could no longer hold his tongue. He strode to the king's side. "Sire, even a lifetime in the dungeon will not raise one grain of wheat on a ruined field. Eden has lost all he hoped to gain. One harvest to keep himself and his wife alive." "You offered me a favor," Taran went on. "I refused it then. Will you let me claim it now?
Ask what you please, my lad,
replied Smoyt.
It is already given.
Taran hesitated a moment as he stepped forward and stood facing the Cantrev lords. Then he turned to Smoyt. I ask you this, he said. Set Gast and Gorion free. While Smoyt blinked in astonishment, Gorion, glimpsing Taran for the first time, exclaimed,
It's the pig-keeper who cozened me out of my horse. I took him for a lout. But he asks a noble favour. Grant it, Smoyt. He speaks wisdom.
Set them free, Taran continued, to labour beside Eden, and strive to mend what they have destroyed.
What?
Cried Gast.
I took him for a hero, but he's no more than a lout.
How dare he ask Gast the Generous
to delve the ground like a mole, and for no reward?
Impudence, impertinence, insolence, shouted Gorion. I'll not have a pig-keeper pass judgment on Gorion the Valorous, nor on Gast the Generous,
exclaimed Gast. Pass judgment on yourselves, then, Taran answered, picking up two handfuls of earth and torn shoots, and holding them before the furious Cantrev lords. This is what remains of Eden's livelihood. As well take a sword and slay him. Look on this, Lord Gorion, for there is more truth here than in your tales of giants and monsters. And this he treasured, Lord Gast, more than you treasure any of your possessions. And it was more truly his own, for he toiled to make it so. Gast and Gorion had fallen silent. The two rough Cantrev lords stared at the ground like sheepish boys. Eden and his wife looked on without speaking.
The lad has a better head on his shoulders than I do, exclaimed Smoyt, and his judgment is wiser. Kinder, too, for my choice would have been the dungeon, not the delving.
The Cantrev lords reluctantly nodded agreement. Taran turned to Smoyt. The rest of my favour is this. Grant most where need is greatest. Do you claim Cornilla for your own? Sire, give her to Eden.
Give up Cornilla?
Smoyt began, sputtering and choking.
My prize of war?
He finally nodded his head.
So be it, lad.
Eden shall keep her, Taran went on, and Gast and Gorion shall have her next calves.
What of my herd? Cried Gorion.
And mine?
Cried Gast.
They're so mixed together, no man can tell his own from another's.
Lord Gorion shall divide the herds in equal portions, Taran said.
He shall not,
Lord Gast broke in.
He'll give me all the scrawny ones, and keep the fat for himself. It's I who'll divide them.
Not so,
shouted Gorion.
You'll fob off none of your raw-boned creatures on me.
Lord Gorion shall divide the herds, Taran repeated. But Lord Gast shall be first to choose his half.
Well said,
Smoyt burst out, roaring with laughter.
My breath and blood, you have them there. Gorion divides, and Gast chooses. Oh, ho, ho, it takes two thieves to strike an honest bargain.
Eden and Alaka had come to stand before Taran and King Smoyt.
Who you may truly be, I do not know, the farmer said to Taran. But you befriended me far better than I befriended you. Oh, wisdom of kindly master,
cried Gurgi, as the Cantrev lords set about dividing their herds, and Smoyt's warriors made ready to return to Caer Cadarn.
Gurgi finds cows, but only wise master knows what to do with them.
If indeed I did rightly, Taran replied, Gast and Gorion will be waiting for Cornillo's calves. Gast said they were always twins. I only hope, he added with a grin, that you doesn't disappoint us. It was long after nightfall when the companions at last reached Caer Cadarn. Fluda and Gurgi were too exhausted to do more than fling themselves onto their couches. Taran would gladly have followed them, but Smoyt took his arm and drew him to the great hall.
Count your day well spent, my lad,
cried Smoyt.
You spared the Cantrev from a war, and me from being drubbed into jelly. As for Gast and Gorion, how long they'll stay at peace with each other, I'll not guess. But you've taught me one thing. My dungeons are useless. My body and bones, I'll have them walled up directly. From this day, I'll try my hand at speaking instead of smiting. And yet, lad,
Smite went on, furrowing his brow,
my wits are slow. I need no man to tell me that, and I am easier in my mind when I have a blade in my hand. Will you return favor for favor? Stay with me in Cantref Cadifor.
Sire, Tyran answered, I seek to learn who my kinsmen are. I cannot—
Kinsmen?
Shouted Smite, slapping his great girth.
There's enough of me to make all the kinsmen you could want. Hear me well,
he added, his voice quieter now.
A widower am I, and childless. Do you yearn for parents? No less do I yearn for a son. When the horn of Gwyn the Hunter sounds for me, there shall be none to take my place, and none would I choose but you. Stay, lad, and you shall one day be king of Cadifor.
King of Cadifor? Tyran cried. His heart leapt. What need to seek the mirror when he could offer Ailanwy a royal throne, the proudest gift he could ever lay at her feet? Tyran, king of Cadifor. The words rang more sweetly in his ears than Tyran, assistant pickkeeper. Yet suddenly his joy turned cold. While Ailanwy might honour his rank, could she respect him for abandoning his quest, even before it had begun? Could he respect himself? For a long while, Tyran did not answer. Then, with fond admiration, he turned his eyes to Smite. The honour you would give me, Tyran began, there is nothing I would value more highly. Yes, I long to accept it. His voice faltered. Yet I would rather hold kingship by right of noble birth, not as a gift. It may be, he went on slowly, that in truth I am nobly born. If it should prove thus, then gladly would I rule Cadifor.
How then, cried Smite, my body and bones, I'd rather see a wise pickkeeper on my throne than a blood prince who's a fool.
But there is this as well, Tyran answered. It is in my heart to learn the truth about myself. I will not stop short of it. Were I to do so, who I truly am would forever be unknown, and through all my life I would feel a part of me lacking. At these words, Smoit's battle-scarred face fell with sadness, and regretfully he bowed his head. But after a moment he clapped Tyran heartily on the back.
My breath, blood, and beard, he cried. You've a will to chase the wild goose, Will-o'-the-wisp, looking-glass, or whatever it may be. And I'll say no more to keep you from it. Seek it out, lad. Whether or not you find it, come back, and Cadifor will welcome you. But hasten, for if Gast and Gorion are ever at loggerheads again, I'll not vouch for how much of the Cantref will be left.
Thus Tyran, with Gergi and Fluda-Flam, set off once more. In his secret heart, Tyran cherished the hope he might return to Smoit's realm with proud tidings of his parentage. Yet he did not foresee how long it would be until he set foot in Cantref Cadifor again. Chapter 6 A Frog. From Caer Cadan, the companions made good progress, and within a few days crossed the River Istrad, where Fluda led them for a time along the farther bank before turning northeastward through the hill Cantrefs. Unlike the valley Cantrefs, these lands were greyish and flinty. What might once have been fair pastureland, Tyran saw to be overlaid with brush, and the long reaches of forest were close-grown and darkly tangled. Fluda admitted his roving seldom brought him to these parts.
The Cantref nobles are as glum as their domains. Play your merriest tune, and the best you can hope for is a sour smile. Yet, if the old lore is true, these realms were as rich as any in Prydaine. The sheep of the hill Cantrefs, great Belin, it said they had fleece so thick you could sink your arm in it up to the elbow. Nowadays, alas, they tend to be a little scruffy.
Eden told me a Rorn Deathlord stole many secrets from the farmers of the valley, Tyran replied. Surely he robbed the shepherds of the hill cantrevs as well. Fluda nodded.
Few treasures he hasn't spoiled or stolen, save those of the fair folk. And even a Rorn might think twice before trifling with them.
Be that as it may, he went on, I'd not change the northern realms, where my own kingdom is, for any of these. There, my boy, we raise no sheep, but famous bards and warriors. Naturally, the House of Flam has held its throne there for, well, for a remarkably long time. In the veins of a Flam, declared the bard, flows royal blood of the sons of Don. Prince Gwydion himself is my kinsman. Distant, distant, it's true, he added hastily, but a kinsman nonetheless.
Gurgi does not care for famous sheep or fleecy bards,
Gurgi wistfully murmured.
He is happy at Caer Dalbyn, oh yes, and wishes he is soon there.
As for that, answered Fluda, I'm afraid you'll have hard travel before you see home again. It's anyone's guess how long it will take to find your mysterious mirror. I'll go with you as far as I can, he said to Taran, though sooner or later I shall have to get back to my kingdom. My subjects are always impatient for my return.
The harp shuddered violently as a string snapped in two. Fluda's face reddened.
Ahem, he said. Yes, what I meant was, I'll be anxious to see them again. The truth of it is, I often have the feeling they manage quite well, even when I'm not there. Still, a Flam is dutiful.
The companions halted while Fluda slid from Lian's back and squatted on the turf to repair his broken string. From his jacket, the bard took the large key, which he used to tighten the harp's wooden pegs, and began patiently retuning the instrument. A raucous cry made Taran glance quickly skyward.
"It's Kor," he exclaimed, pointing to the winged shape plummeting swiftly toward the companions.
Gurgi shouted joyfully and clapped his hands as the crow alighted on Taran's wrist.
"So you found us, old friend," cried Taran, delighted to have the crow with him once again.
"Tell me," he went on quickly, "how does Ailanwë fare? Does she miss all of us?"
"Princess!" Kor croaked, beating his wings. "Princess! Ailanwë! Taran!"
He clacked his beak, hopped up and down on Taran's wrist, and set up such a jabbering and chattering that Taran could barely make out one word from another. The best he could understand was that Ailanwë's indignation at being forced to learn royal behaviour had by no means dwindled, and that indeed she missed him, tidings that both cheered Taran and sharpened his yearning for the golden-haired princess. In the cavern on Mona, Kor also managed to convey, Glue the giant had been restored to his original size by Dalban's potion. Kor himself was in the best of spirits. Still gabbling at the top of his voice, he flapped his glossy black wings, hopped from Taran's wrist to greet the other companions, and even perched on Lian's head, where he busily ran his beak through the great cat's tawny fur.
"His eyes will help our search," Taran said to Fluda, who had left his harp to come and stroke the bird's sleek feathers.
"Kor can scout the land better than any of us."
"So he can," agreed Fluda, "if he has a mind to, and if you can make him heed you. Otherwise the scamp will have his beak in everyone's business but his own."
"Yes, yes," Gurgi added, shaking a finger at the crow. "Heed commands of kindly master. Help him with flyings and spyings, not pryings and lyings."
In answer, the crow impudently thrust out a sharp black tongue. With a flirt of his tail, he fluttered to the harp and began rapidly twanging the strings with his beak. At the bard's cry of protest, Kor hopped from the instrument's curved frame and snatched up the tuning key, which he began dragging across the turf.
"He's brazen as a magpie," cried Fluda, setting off after the crow. "He's thieving as a jackdaw."
No sooner did Fluda come within half a pace of him than Kor nimbly hopped away again, bearing the key in his beak. Squawking merrily, the crow stayed always out of Fluda's grasp, and Taran could not help laughing at the sight of the long-shanked bard vainly racing in circles while Kor danced ahead of him. When Gurgi and Taran joined the pursuit, and Taran's fingers had come within a hairbreadth of the crow's tail feathers, Kor shot upward and flapped teasingly a short distance into the woods. There he lighted on the gnarled branch of a tall, ancient oak, and peered with bright, beady eyes at the companions gathered below. "Come down," Taran ordered, as sternly as he could, for the bird's comical antics made it impossible for him to be seriously angry.